So, how many do we have registered?
We're just about ready to start, Michael, and I'll send you all that information when we're finished.
Perfect.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the monthly Lunch and Leadership conference call. If you'd like a copy of today's slides, just send an email to Mary at Scarlet Leadership, and we will get those slides out to you. We're also going to have some additional resources that Michael will speak about today that will be available on our website tomorrow after we post the conference call. So if you have a question during the call, select star 7. That will unmute you, and you can ask your question. Or if you're watching and listening online, you can just enter a question into the box, and we will address that. So at this point, without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to the world-famous Joe Scarlet.
Thanks, Tom. Welcome, everybody, to the and we're going to get right into it in a minute, but I got to do a little commercial for our next call. Our next call will be on Thursday, June 19th. Happens to be the day after I return from a vacation in Russia, assuming I return. And our speaker at the next one is going to be Bob Boardman. Is a longtime consultant to retail companies. He's an author of the book called The Must-Have Customer, Seven Steps to Winning. And it's all about customers and how to build customer relationships, how to maintain them, and how to understand where the pitfalls might be. Bob's a great speaker, great author, and I'm sure you get a lot out of that. All about customers, June 19th. Today's topic is life balance and longevity, and we're thrilled to have Michael Hewitt with us. Michael's the research director for executive physiology at Canyon Ranch in Tucson, Arizona. He's been working with us, I guess, about 8 years since the very beginning of the Scarlet Leadership Institute, and Michael kicks off, actually does the first class at our executive retreat. And it's a very interesting class and a very interesting way to start an executive program, because we think that managing yourself physically and managing your time is an essential beginning point to being a good leader. The whole topic today is about life balance and longevity, which is both the matter of managing your own time and then taking care of yourself in a physical way so that you live for a long time. Just up front, though, there are no quick fixes. Improving yourself on these measures is about long-term lifestyle changes and in many cases, long-term management practice changes. But with that, I'll turn it over to Mary Fink. Mary, it's all yours.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you, Joe. And before I start with our questions for Michael, I have a couple of comments about Michael. He is one of the favorite teachers that we have in the Signature Executive Program. People love what you have to say. They're always saying, can we be with him longer? Can we have more of his time? And the truth of the matter is we just don't have that time in the schedule, but he is very popular because he brings a message that everyone can relate to. The other thing I wanted to say before I started my questions was we have an opportunity in June, on June 12th, for an open enrollment advanced negotiation class. Almost everyone who goes through one of our programs has the negotiations class with Susan Williams. This is an advanced class, multi-party, multi-issue, and it's just taking what we've learned in the negotiations class up a notch and for larger groups. So I think it's something that a lot of people will have an interest in. The information is on our website if you're interested. So now, Michael, when we say work-life balance, and I know that's a term that you really don't like, we're really talking about life balance, right?
Absolutely. Joe, Mary, thank you for the kind introduction, and I'm delighted to be here. When we talk about work-life balance, it implies that work and life are different things. And they're not. Our life balance involves the time that we spend with family and friends, the time we spend with work, the time we spend managing ourselves, sleep, and so on. So I don't like the implication, but I do understand the concept. And it's a tremendous challenge in modern times, and especially a tremendous challenge for business leaders.
Joe, talk to us a little bit about your thoughts about this, because I know as someone who ran a large company and CEO for a long time, there are a lot of you out there that CEOs, that don't spend a lot of time thinking about balance or practicing balance. And I know that when we spoke with CEOs in the past, they have said, I'm not a good model for that, but I want my staff to be. So talk to us about how you were able to do that in your career.
Well, it's about all things in life. It's about setting priorities, and you got to figure out what's important to you and what's not important to you. And as I'm sure you've heard me say before, I worked hard, but I was not a workaholic, and I was able to put things into perspective. And as you rise up the ranks of leadership, your ability to delegate responsibility and hold each one of your key people responsible for things and not put the monkey on your back. If you insist on making every decision, you insist on reading every line and every report, you're forever going to be a workaholic, and you're going to have a hard time managing your own time. You're going to have a hard time taking care of yourself physically, because it's my belief, and I'm sure I read this, that workaholics tend to be much less healthy people and therefore are not going to live as long. So it's about setting priorities. It's about doing the right thing. I can share a story with you, a Tractor Supply story, going back into the 20 years ago or so. We were having a high failure rate among promoted store managers promoted to being a district manager, and when we studied it carefully, we found that we were promoting to store managers who had absolutely the most stellar stores. Well, that doesn't translate, because much of what they were doing is what they were doing themselves. They were working very, very hard. And then we looked at it and we said our most successful district managers were store managers who had worked hard but weren't killing themselves. And when they went home at night or took their day off or their vacation, they weren't called every 5 minutes. They just simply had built organizations around them. So as you think about yourself in leadership roles, the better you surround the people you surround yourself with and the more clearly you delegate and push decision-making down the ladder, the more time you have to set priorities and subsequently live a more balanced life. Long answer to a short question.
No, I like your answer, and I know that you didn't miss vacations and you didn't miss activities with your children when they were important because you made them priorities. So can we say that the way we achieve it is to be intentional about having it?
Oh, absolutely. You got to set the plan. You got to know where you're going, and you got to put things in the right perspective. We all have these Outlook calendars. If you just go in there and say, okay, at 3 o'clock on Friday afternoon, my son is going to be in a baseball game, and I'm just going to block that time out of my calendar and not let anybody take that time, that's how you can set the right priorities. Now, that doesn't mean you don't compensate for that somewhere else down the road, but you've got to really take charge of your life, take charge of your time, and that's how you can set the right priorities. Michael?
Right.
You know, when we think about the cost to a company to recruit, to move, to train new managers, for them to learn the company culture, for them to make the contacts and alliances, that cost is tremendous to a company. And so any encouragement leaders can give to their primary reports to take care of themselves is really a good investment in the company itself.
No question about that. So if we're talking about balancing our lives, and Joe, I've heard you say this, it doesn't mean 50-50, right?
No, it doesn't. It means doing what makes the most sense, and it doesn't necessarily mean a 50-50 balance. It may be 60-40 one week or 70-30 another week or vice versa. It goes back and forth based on what's really important. Your kid's ball game is not always the most important thing. There's some things that are in business that are a lot more important, and then there are some days in which the ball game is more important.
Exactly. And I know that also business cycles, and everybody's business has a different cycle, but I know I've heard you talk about telling your managers, you know, to let their families know that in the springtime, when it's the farming time and the planting time, that, you know, chances are they're going to spend some long hours at the store, and then you can make it up later. So it's not every day is balanced. It's that in the big picture, things are balanced.
We would tell our store managers, I'm sure we still do today, that our busiest months of the year are April and May. You got to be working hard in April and May, and you simply communicate that with your family, let them know ahead of time, and then make sure that when the end of June rolls around, you take them away for a long weekend.
Exactly. Michael?
All right. So I think we would agree that developing professional longevity is a good investment for a company, and I think that's really linked with personal longevity. My research interest and my my primary topic for speaking is longevity, and it's not lifespan specifically, it's well span or health span. Given
right.
the choice of living to 90 and spending the last 6 years in nursing care, or being vibrant and healthy until 84 and then passing quickly doing something you love, most of us are going to opt for the second, although we might change our mind at 83 and a half.
That's
and so
true.
I'm very interested in what can we do to increase our individual longevity. And the great news is that we are living longer. I have in front of me the latest data from the American Human Development Culture's Measure of America. It's a lifespan by state. And when I look at these numbers from 2014 and compare them to the last set, which was 2006, across the board, in virtually all of the states, we've increased longevity from somewhere between 2 and 4%. The longest-lived state is Hawaii, which is a nice choice. Life expectancy at birth there, men and women combined, was 80 in 2006, and now it's 82.7. So we are certainly living longer. A child born today has a life expectancy of about 78. It is different for men and women. Life expectancy for American women at birth is 81, and American males at birth is 76.
Mm.
And there's tremendous disparity among the states. But the very encouraging data from this latest finding is that there are now 12 states that have a life expectancy at birth of greater than 80 years. They run Hawaii, Minnesota, Connecticut, California, Massachusetts, New York, Vermont, New Hampshire, New Jersey, Utah, Colorado, and Wisconsin.
Wow.
8 years ago, there was only one, only Hawaii.
But that is great.
The discouraging thing, of course, is that there are some shorter-lived states as well. The last in the list is Mississippi, with a life expectancy of 75, compared to 82.7 for Hawaii is quite a span there. Also,
so your advice would be to move to the beach?
I would suggest leaving Mississippi for Hawaii, if that's possible, yes. Number two well, on the list is my home state of Minnesota, and I think people there are just freeze-dried, but they do live long. Now, what's
great.
Interesting is that it varies a lot. The United States in longevity at birth isn't even in the top 10 in the world.
Wow.
The longest-lived group are Japanese women who have a life expectancy at birth of 87, 7.5% more than American women.
Wow.
And among men in Iceland, I guess that's Minnesota again, at 81.2, again about 7% longer than the average for American men. So
right.
I'm not suggesting we move to Japan or Iceland, but I am suggesting that there are many things we can do to increase both our longevity and also our health for however many years we have.
Yes, and there are things that we can learn from those populations that can help us do that as well. Which leads me to my next question. You're all the time talking, Michael, about living younger, longer. And
yes.
I know that you talk about three things that are secrets to living younger, longer. Can you talk to us about those?
Well, there's a number of things, but to start with simply longevity, if you want to know what works well, you would study the successful agers. And there's a long ongoing study from the University of Georgia called the Georgia Centenarian Study. The principal researcher is Leonard Poon. It's been ongoing now for a number of years. The original study got a census from the state of Georgia that listed the names and addresses and telephone numbers of everyone in the state who was 100 years old or older. And they set out to interview all of the individuals on that list, and most of them were happy to have someone come chat with them. And they were looking for characteristics that these successful agers shared. What did the centenarians do in common that allowed them to live so long? And, of course, genetics is a factor, but it's a much smaller factor than people believe. Well, as an exercise specialist, I was convinced it was going to be physical activity. But that didn't make the list, although 100 years ago we were certainly more active than we are now. Our registered dietitians were convinced it was going to be fresh fruits and vegetables, but that wasn't it either. But they found three things that were common among these successful agers. And number one on the list was a sense of purpose. Everyone they spoke to had something that enthused them, something they were excited to get up and do. And it makes sense. If you're going to get up every day for 100 years, you better have something to do. It didn't seem to matter what it was. It could be a membership in the Rotary or the Lions or one of those organizations. It could be being involved in the family business. It could be their church or their mosque or their synagogue. It could be their bocce ball league. It didn't seem to matter what it was. But everyone had a purpose of some sort. And we see that often. We see very successful company leaders who are in charge of a large division or the entire company who go into retirement and now are in charge of Wednesday trash pickup. Their decline is dramatic and really quite terrifying. And so having something to do for that next phase of the life or for every phase of life is critical. The second on the list was resilience, the ability to bounce back from setbacks. And again, if you've lived 100 years, you've seen a lot of setbacks. You've lived through at least one world war. You've seen, obviously, the past of your parents and grandparents and siblings, probably, and if you're 100 years older, maybe even your children. And so the ability to bounce back from these tragic things that happen is a skill that is related to longevity. And I'll touch in a moment about developing resilience, but it's a critical trait. And the third trait among these successful centenarians was optimism. The centenarians apparently believe they will live long and well, and they do, and the pessimists believe they're going to die young, and apparently they do. So they're both right. And the question, of course, is, all right, if sense of purpose and resilience and optimism are the traits of longevity, what if you're not? What if you're not so resilient, or you're not that much of an optimistic, and you're not certain of your purpose? Can you develop those skills? And there's a whole branch of behavioral health that addresses that. But I would argue that the traits for longevity, resilience and sense of purpose and optimism, are exactly the same traits you would want in a business leader.
Hmm.
If the CEO of your company does not have a sense of purpose, is not particularly resilient, and is not, to a major degree, an optimist — I'm not talking about blind optimism — he or she is not likely to maintain that position as CEO, and the company is likely to have some rough times ahead. So I think there's a parallel between these longevity and professional longevity traits.
Right. We have a slide that lists the seven elements of resilience, and I don't want to go through all seven of those right now. It's from The Resilience Factor, and that's a book that is a great read. It has an assessment in it. It also has ideas for how you can develop these things. But if you want to say a little more about it, Michael — but first, Joe, I wanted to ask you, is that why you play racquetball with such a fervor?
I play racquetball because it's great exercise and it's a lot of fun. And I can't stand to just sit there on a treadmill and march back and forth. But racquetball is great exercise because it's competitive. And it's fun, and when you finish playing racquetball for an hour and a half, you know that you've done something.
Exactly. And wanting to whip your opponent wouldn't be part of it, would it?
It would be. That helps inspire me.
That's your
That's
sense
the
of
fun part.
Okay, Michael, talk to us a little about resilience. As I said, we can't go through all of them, but that's a great reference if you have an interest in knowing more.
Well, it's interesting. There's been a long, long history of the social sciences studying what's wrong with people. We look at people who are depressed or have anxiety or bipolar disorder, if you will, the negative side of behavioral health. But there are a couple of individuals, Marty Seligman out of Pennsylvania and our own Dr. Dan Baker here at Canyon Ranch, who asked the question, why are we investing all of our resources studying what's wrong with people? Why don't we study the resilient? Why don't we study the optimist? Why don't we look at who's doing things right and see what we can learn from them? And from that question rose an entire branch of behavioral health called positive psychology. And the premise of positive psychology is that there are people who are behaviorally above the norm, well above the standard, and they're doing something different than the others. And so if this is the topic that interests you, Martin Seligman has written a couple of wonderful books. I love the titles, by the way. One is called Authentic Happiness, and the second is called Learned Optimism. The concept that you can learn to be optimistic is really very empowering. And if it's a topic that interests you, I encourage you to follow up. Martin Seligman, really the father of positive psychology. He was the president of the American Psychological Association, and he made it his platform to bring positive psychology to the forefront, and it's become quite mainstream now. The second is Dr. Dan Baker, who was a family business consultant here at Canyon Ranch for a number of years. He wrote a book based on the individuals that he had met here at Canyon Ranch and in his private practice called What Happy People Know. It's a series of stories about what happy people do right. It's a nice short read, easy read, and I encourage you to follow it. But because that book was so successful, he had a follow-up book called What Happy Companies Know. And again, the concept was, instead of studying the companies that are struggling, why don't we study the successful companies, the optimistic companies, and see what traits they share? And there's likely to be some gems in there for our listeners today, our participants today, on what they might incorporate in their own companies as well.
Yes, and I plan to put on our website, once we have the recording ready to go on our website of this call, a bibliography so that you don't have to remember the names of these books and who wrote them.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Mary,
all right,
Mary,
go ahead.
Let's interrupt for a second, Mary. You know, being positive is contagious, and when you work in a positive environment, you tend to feel more positive. And those of you who are in leadership roles, when you show that you're positive, other people get on the same bandwagon. And if I can give everybody a suggestion, practice patting people on the back, because it makes you feel good, and it makes the person who's receiving the pat on the back feel good, and it creates an environment of generally speaking, a pretty positive attitudes.
It does. And the other thing that makes a difference is, even if you get up in the morning and you don't feel like you're that positive, put on a happy face and act like you're really positive, and sometimes it makes a difference in form following function.
There was an interesting study on that topic, looking at the biochemical changes that happen when people laugh. Laughter, of course, is fun and contagious, but it has some fairly significant biochemical effects. It changes the hormonal balance, catecholamines, and so on. Well, in this particular study, they had people laugh, and they measured their blood levels of a number of chemicals, particularly the catecholamines, and they saw tremendous drops in the stress hormones when people laughed. But as it turns out, it didn't matter whether they were really laughing or they were fake laughing. They had a group of graduate students simply fake laughter, and the biochemical changes were equally good to those who were actually laughing. Of course, when you sit in a room with others and you fake laughter, they begin to laugh too, so it is kind of contagious.
Right.
But even at the cellular level, that optimism, that laughter, the fun Joe has when he does whip his opponent is making some biochemical changes in the stress hormones.
I love it. And I think that, Joe, you have a comment, and I think you're one of those people that believes in having fun and a little joy in the workplace. And I think that that happiness and that light attitude makes a huge difference, not only in yourself, but in those people around you.
There's no downside in having fun. It makes everybody feel good. And if I'm not mistaken, you live longer if you're happier anyway. So there's no downside in having some fun. At Tractor Supply, because nearly 90% of our people are customer-facing, you really want people to be having fun. There's no downside to it, and there's lots and lots of upside.
All right. Let's talk for a minute then, Michael, about the fundamentals of health. You have written an article, and that article will also be available on the website when we post the call. But they are nutrition, exercise, stress management, and sleep. And I want you to talk a little bit about each of those, and then I want you to let us know, if I can only do one, which one should I start with?
Okay, fair enough. That particular platform, if you will, came from a series of talks I had given to CEOs here at Canyon Ranch for a number of years. I talked really about preventative medicine, and they said, we'd like this topic. Would you be willing to write a little article on it for our Compass magazine so that all our members could hear this message? And that is the reprint that I'm sharing. But the premise of this is that we talk so much in the United States about preventative medicine, but we don't really practice it. We have what I believe is the world's finest disease management system. if you need a liver transplant, you're going to go to the Mayo Clinic or the Cleveland Clinic or one of the top medical centers here, because you'll get better care than anywhere else on the planet. But if you want to prevent heart disease, you want to prevent diabetes, the United States is ranked, I believe, 17th worldwide, right behind Cuba. So we don't do a particularly good job on preventative medicine. And I believe preventative medicine is mom's medicine. Mom was right so many times, and in this case, definitely so. Every mom on the planet says, eat your vegetables. Nutrition is a cornerstone of good health. Mom said, it's a great day, go out and play. Physical activity or exercise is a component, a foundation of good health. Certainly my mom said, do your homework first, and I'm sure yours did as well. Stress management is the third of the foundations, and every mom on the planet says, it's bedtime, get to bed, and that's the fourth. So what I call the foundations of health are physical activity, nutrition, stress management, and sleep, and together they form the platform on which vitality and longevity rest. Well, the reality is that virtually anyone who's listening in on this call is going to have a job that involves stress. And stress is not an evil concept. It's actually a very good thing in our lives, and I'll come back to that. But if you have a highly stressful position, one leg may be a little compromised. If you've got a four-legged stool and one leg is a little compromised, you can still sit on it if the other three legs are solid. But what if your stress is elevated and you're eating poorly? Or your stress is elevated and your sleep is compromised, or your stress is elevated and you're failing to exercise, the entire platform collapses. And so the premise is, what can we do to shore up each of those legs? Now, why doesn't your physician talk to you every time about nutrition and stress management and sleep and physical activity? And the answer is, in medical schools today, physicians get zero exposure, none at all, to nutrition. Not a single class or course in exercise. There's no component of stress management in medical school, and unless they're a sleep specialist, they get no exposure to sleep medicine. In fact, during their residencies, we teach physicians to abuse all four. We have them doing 18-hour shifts of high stress.
Go ahead.
I'm getting a message here. Of high stress.
Go ahead now.
Interesting.
I know.
Michael, maybe you can call in on a different phone. In the meantime, I'll carry on the conversation a little bit in terms of stress. We all work to some degree with stress, but how we manage stress has a lot to do with how positive we are and what our attitude is, and how we delegate responsibility and how we assign tasks to both ourselves and to others. I got accused of being a stress carrier, but sort of humorously there. But I believed in putting maximum amount of responsibility on the people working for me, and even chunks for the 6 or 8 or 10 people that work for me. And when you're in a leadership role and you can put responsibility on the backs of the people who are accountable for it, you really take it off your own. And plus, the further down you push responsibility, the closer to the action it is, and probably the better job that's going to be done. So when you think about managing stress, it's just getting the monkey off your back and putting it on the backs of the people it belongs on. And if everybody up and down the chain works like that, you're pushing responsibility closest to the front lines, which is where it's almost always better executed.
No question.
Michael, are you back?
I think we've temporarily lost Michael, but again, these four elements or foundations of health are going to be in an article that we will make available as resources. And the last point that I'd like to make before we go to questions is, And Joe, you can answer this question as well as anyone. What one thing would you suggest that someone do as a first step toward balance? And I know I want to go back to the foundations for just a minute and remind everyone that Michael says of the four, if you can only do one, work on the sleep part, because that is the one that we cannot do without. Michael, are you back?
I am back.
Okay.
Nice job following the message. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Mary, you're absolutely right. The four foundations are all important, but I would argue that sleep is the very most important. If you think about it, how long can you go with a stressful job? Well, most people, how long have they been working? We go decades with fairly significant stress. And while we don't necessarily thrive, we can function. We go a very long time with a poor diet.
Right.
Ultimately, it will do us great harm, but we could go 30 days with no food whatsoever. We can go a fairly long time with no physical activity, although, again, we won't thrive, we'll survive. But 48 hours without sleep, and we will be hallucinating. It's critically important. Now, the great news is that you don't have to make dramatic changes to improve the quality of your sleep. We talk a lot about both sleep ecology and sleep hygiene. Ecology refers to the environment in which you sleep, and hygiene, the rituals. So the environment in which you sleep is best modeled after the best sleepers of all mammals, the bears. Bears crawl into their den in the fall. It's cool. It's dark. It's quiet. They wake up in the spring and say, huh, I have cubs. How did that happen? Very, very good sleepers. But we don't always have that kind of environment. And so a simple self-check to improve the quality of sleep is to ensure that your sleeping environment is cool, not cold. That does not work well. Cool, quiet, and especially dark. Now, quiet isn't always easy. If you live next to a noisy area, some white noise machines may give you some help there. But the quieter, the better. Earplugs tend not to work because you don't hear your alarm. But the quieter, the better. But dark is something that's quite powerful. And interestingly, human beings are not sensitive to red light. Red light does not disrupt sleep, as does white or blue or any other color. So a quick inventory of your bedroom to make sure that all of the indicator lights on the smoke alarm and the alarm clock and so on, if those numerals or indicator lamps are red, they will not disrupt your sleep. But if they're any other color, they will. Many of us need a night light if we get up in the middle of the evening to use the restroom. If you have a night light that is red, it won't disrupt your sleep like any other color. But the hygiene refers to the rituals. When we have children who we want to get to sleep, the last thing we do is invite over their friends for a pillow fight or a wrestling match right before bed. Instead, we have a whole ritual of a little quiet time, some quiet reading, maybe a warm bath, a story, rub the back, put to bed with a kiss. If you can find someone to give you a warm bath and quiet time and read you a story and rub your back and put you to bed with a kiss, you'll sleep well too. But we do the antithesis. We check our email one more time. We watch the evening news, really the opposite of a quiet, calming environment. So the email can wait until morning, and if you can't live without Letterman or now Jimmy Fallon's monologues, and if it's Letterman's, you're in trouble soon, Tebow, great choice. They're just as funny in the morning as they were in the evening, and they enhance the quality of your sleep. But the real question is, how much sleep do you need? And that varies tremendously from person to person. My suggestion is attempt to get 15 minutes more than you're doing now. You feel dramatically better with just 15 minutes of additional sleep. When that becomes habitual, see if you get at another 15.
So it's not like I have to plan to spend 2 more hours sleeping. It's very gradual and incremental.
It can make a big difference. I mean, we suffer when daylight savings come, but not very long. Once you set yourself to go to bed 15 minutes earlier, it becomes quite comfortable, it becomes quite natural, but your function is much, much improved.
That is all great information. We've been talking for a while now, and I am sure that there are some questions out there among our listeners. If you are on the line, you can hit *7, or if you're online, if you're on the phone line, *7. If you're online, enter your question in the box and hit submit. What questions do you have? While we're waiting, Michael, what one thing do you think would be the best thing that someone could do as a first step toward balance of all the things you've talked about, the fundamentals of health and optimism and purpose and resiliency and all those things? What would be your first step?
Well, we really see the traits of work-life imbalance. And one of the concepts of imbalance is the concept of presenteeism. Every company has to deal with absenteeism. If workers are not showing up for work, or they're coming to work not adequately prepared or rested, or in some cases, sadly, even hungover or ill, their productivity and the quality of their work and the number of mistakes they make are going to be affected. So presenteeism, however, is the opposite concept. And it can have as much of a cost to a company as absenteeism. How many times does a typical worker in our culture come into work when they're sick because they feel they have to? So presenteeism is defined as a sense of, I must come into work even when I'm not feeling 100% because I need to demonstrate my productivity, demonstrate my team spirit, if you will. And the quality of the work is really quite low. So along those lines, the one thing that we can do is deal with perfectionism. Joe was referring to the manager who feels that he or she has to read every line of every memo, has to be involved in every single decision, because they have a sense of perfectionism and they don't necessarily trust their direct reports to do all those decisions. And so there's a wonderful quote. It's better in French than in English, but I don't speak French. It comes from Voltaire, and the quote says, "The perfect is the enemy of the good."
Wow.
And now I'm not suggesting that we should accept substandard work, but if every project in every area must be done perfectly, there will be very few projects completed.
Right, we're setting ourselves up for failure if we believe that.
That's exactly right. And so being able to look at the project and say, it must be done well, and it must be done on time, and it must be done within budget, but all of those things can't be done if it also must be done absolutely perfectly. Something has to give in that.
Exactly.
And so we are constantly striving to do better and better and more, but if our expectation is perfect, we will be guaranteed to be unsuccessful.
We have one question online, and that is, what if my boss makes me feel like I have to come in? What if I don't feel that I can call in sick? Now, I know if I'm really, really sick, someone's going to understand that, but what if I am discouraged from the occasional sick day? And Joe, you might want to answer this.
Well, I almost went with a response, get your resume ready. But it's a tough situation. Sometimes an honest conversation with the boss is the right thing to do. Sometimes just do what you need to do. The bottom line is, what are you accomplishing? Are you really doing the job? Are you getting things done? Whatever your mission is, are you achieving? If you're achieving the mission, you're probably in good shape from a security standpoint. If you're not achieving the mission, then the boss is upset about you taking sick time. I can understand that. So take a look at what you're doing, what you're getting. If you're getting the job accomplished and you need some time off, your boss should understand that, and you should be able to go to him or her and talk about that from in an adult fashion. If not, maybe talking to the HR department in your company.
Right, and I'm not really talking about someone abusing sick leave. I'm talking about someone who, we talk a lot about cultures and organizations, and there are cultures where people brag about, I went to work, had a fever, I was throwing up, and The next thing I know is I have a fever and I'm throwing up. So there are many reasons why it makes sense to be responsible about time off.
You know, it's interesting that we were speaking about longevity, and Japan has the greatest longevity for females, but it's not quite as high as it is for males. And much of that is the Japanese work concept called karoshi. Karoshi is a Japanese term that roughly translates into death by overwork. And Japan is among the very worst in workers not taking their paid vacation. They use a very small percentage of it on average. And the expectations are very high for quality work, but also for time invested in the office. The appearances of hard work in that culture are almost as important as the quality of the hard work. And Japanese workers, many Japanese workers die related to health impacts of having not enough time off, not enough time to take care of themselves. In fact, there's a concept called, I'll get this word wrong, karushi suko, which is suicide by overwork. And the fact that such terms even exist in our language implies something. There's even, quite interesting, a little perverse, there's a video game, which are very popular in Japan, called Suicide Salaryman. It's a karoshi game. And unlike most video games where the intent is to live long, the goal of karoshi video game is to die as quickly as possible on the job.
Wow.
You take a post-it note with your instructions, and if you follow them, your goal is to end your life quickly. It's very twisted and funny in a sad sort of way.
And yet there's a lot of truth to that. We do. There are many people who think the solution to or the pathway to success is working ourselves to death, and we see the results of that every day, don't we?
Yeah, certainly.
I can tell you as a boss, when I see people working round the clock, I think to myself, why are they working round the clock? Can't they get the job done in a reasonable amount of time? And that does the opposite. It doesn't impress me at all. It sends the opposite message. It sends a message that you're not really confident if you're there 12 hours a day, 5 days a week, or 6 days a week.
And that's a culture thing that differs in every organization, but it's something to think about, especially if for those of you out there who are managing other people. You don't want to set that expectation, nor do you want to model it. What other questions do you have? If there are none, I would end this call by asking Michael, what one thing do you think we should remember from all the things that you've said? What one piece of advice would you give us and reiterate for us?
There's a belief that it is selfish for one to take care of themselves. And I would say the most important thing is to recognize that taking care of yourself is the very best thing you can do for your company, for your family, for your friends and loved ones. We all know the story of the oxygen mask. You get on the aircraft, and they explain that if you're traveling with a child or someone needs assistance, you should put your mask on first. And everyone understands this. But if you ask them why they direct us to that, they say because they want you to be able to help others. But I would argue if you don't take care of yourself, not only are you unable to help others, frankly, you're in their way. And so
exactly.
the greatest thing you can do for your company and for your family and for yourself is to put yourself a little higher in the priorities. We live in a culture where taking care of others is noble, and I of course love and respect that, but taking care of oneself is perhaps the most important thing of all.
Okay. Do we have a caller? Okay, Joe. Any last words?
Nope. It's great, Michael. Glad you're with us today. Great talk, and look forward to seeing you all on Thursday, June 19th. Thursday, June 19th. See you then.
And right. And remember that there will be resources available as well as the recording of this call available in about 24 hours. And those resources will be a list of books that Michael has suggested, the article Fundamentals of Health, and And I am going to add another resource called the Balance Wheel. And for those of you who have been in the class, if you have, you know that it's an opportunity for you to answer some questions and get a sense of where your wheel is out of balance. So we leave you with that. We look forward to seeing you in a month, and have a great rest of the day.